Welcome to the Lou Cutino Show, where we can learn to reimagine our lifestyle.
Dr. James Doty, what a pleasure to have you. What a pleasure to have you. I know we spoke a couple of times when you were back in California, and I was supposed to come down and meet you for a dinner, which didn't happen, but here we are today, connected on our podcast, Reimagine Your Lifestyle. And I always wanted you on my show because the little that we spoke, even once when you were in Dubai, what really impressed me about you was your compassion about compassion and how passionate you were about the subject. And, you know, I thought you were into religion and spirituality. And then when I got to know, you know, certain people told me, Luke, he's at Stanford and he's a professor of neurosurgery. He's in neuroscience. And he, you know, just kind of puzzled me, your journey from neurosurgery into traveling around the world, being with the Pope, the Dalai Lama, and bringing compassion into people's lives. You know, I think the best person to do justice to your introduction would be you. So thank you for being on the show. And over to you, Dr. James. Please take us through your amazing journey from the time you were a child right up till now. Yeah.
Well, Luke, thank you so much. And thank you for all the work you're doing to improve people's lives. And really, that's, I think, my purpose. Obviously, it's your purpose. So you asked me about my story. As you know, all of us have a backstory. And oftentimes that backstory can result in a good future or a challenging future or obviously a bad future. So my story began as a child. My father was an alcoholic. My mother had had a stroke when I was a child, was partially paralyzed. I had a seizure disorder, ended up being chronically depressed, attempting suicide multiple times. We were on public assistance essentially my entire childhood. So the question, of course, is in that type of a background, what is the likelihood to overcome that, or if you will, to be successful? And like so many people in this world, it's the intervention or the help of a single person that can inspire you, motivate you, teach you. And for me, that ended up being a woman I met in a magic shop, believe it or not. And what would happen at my home when there was conflict, I would often leave and get on my bicycle and ride as fast and as far away as I could. And in this instance, I ended up at a magic shop in a strip mall. And I went in there, and there was this woman there who greeted me with this radiant smile. And I'm sure all of us have met people like this, who their mere presence almost makes you feel joyful and happy. And she was that type of a person. And it turned out she knew nothing about magic. She was actually the owner's mother. But we began a conversation. And the interesting thing about it, I was 12 years old at the time, is that obviously, I had no self-awareness. I was very shy. I was insecure and frankly ashamed of my background. So typically, I wouldn't freely interact with somebody, and this woman was in her 50s. But we connected immediately, and she asked a series of questions, some of which I was embarrassed to answer, but in fact did answer. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, she said to me, "I really like you. And I'm here for another 6 weeks. And if you show up every day, I think I could teach you something that could really help you." Now, I knew nothing about what she was really talking about. But what I did know, she was a very kind lady. And she was also giving me chocolate chip cookies. And the reality was I had absolutely nothing else to do that day for that summer. So I showed up every day. And over 1.5 to 2 hours, she taught me some really profound techniques. And you have to remember, this was before we talked about neuroplasticity, the ability to change your brain, mindfulness. So she did start out with a typical mindfulness exercise, which was one to do a body scan, which is what we call it today. But this was this idea of relaxing the body. And what I did not realize was that from my background, I was always looking around for something to happen because my background was one of complete chaos. You never knew what was going to happen next. And so you're always in this fear mode. which, as you know, stimulates your sympathetic nervous system. You're anxious. You have all these hormones that are being released because you may need to act suddenly. And of course, when you're in that mode, it limits your decision-making. It limits your ability to have access to memories and experiences to help you make the best decision. It's hard for you to be present. And so she taught me this relaxation exercise. And to be bluntly honest with you, I thought it was a waste of my time, but I went ahead and practiced it. And I found I could relax my body, and it changed sort of just how I interacted with others. And from there, she taught me an understanding about the negative dialogue that was going on in my head. And unfortunately, for so many of us, and we can talk about why that is, but the reality is many of us have this negative voice going on in our head that tells us we're not good enough, we're not smart enough, we're not worthy. And the problem is that your thoughts become reality. If you tell yourself it's not possible, if you tell yourself you're not worthy, if you tell yourself you don't deserve love, then those thoughts become your reality. And in fact, what you're doing is you're giving your agency away. You're giving away your ability to make decisions and putting it outside of yourself, saying, well, it's the circumstances that caused this. So once she taught me that I had this dialogue going on in my head that actually didn't relate to reality, it allowed me to change that dialogue, and which is really, really important. It changed it from one of being hypercritical, oftentimes more critical of me than anybody I would criticize that I know. And it changed the dialogue to one of self-affirmation. I am worthy. I deserve this. I'm smart. And that changed everything. And I think one of the great things about mindfulness practices is that it teaches you not to react to thoughts going on in your head. But she added more to that, if you will, which is not just being non-reactive, but changing the thoughts to ones of positivity. And then from there, once you're able to be kind or compassionate to yourself, it allows you to look through a different lens, and you recognize that on some level, everyone is suffering. Now, it may be quite different from yours, but everyone is suffering. And the other mistake we make oftentimes is we look at our situation, especially if we're in poverty or having the challenges I described in my own life. But I learned that there are people who seemingly have everything, but are suffering deeply. And as I've gotten older, it's become readily apparent that there are people who are some of the most affluent people in the world who have very, very challenging, difficult circumstances. And it makes you remember that having money, position, and power does not make you happy. Although a lot of people, especially in Western capitalist society, if you will, have this notion that, well, if I just, you know, make X amount of money, if I just, you know, have this car or live in this mansion or have this position where people recognize me as important, I'm going to be happy and all my problems are going to be solved. And unfortunately, it's just not true whatsoever. From my own background, I worked very hard to get into a college and medical school. And, became, as you pointed out, a neurosurgeon, a professor at Stanford. I was a successful entrepreneur, a CEO of a company that ultimately was valued at $1.3 billion. And here I was. I had a Porsche, Ferrari, Mercedes, a Range Rover, BMW, all in my garage. And I lived on a penthouse, and I had a house overlooking the ocean in Newport Beach. And I was single at the time. I had gotten divorced. And here I was, all these people saying, God, you have everything, man. God, you're the luckiest guy in the world. And I was dating these models and flying around in private jets. And I will tell you, I was never more unhappy in my entire life. Because on some level, here I had everything, but it didn't feel good. It wasn't fulfilling to me. It wasn't dealing with the empty spot that I had, which is this longing for acceptance. And then I realized that it doesn't come from external affirmation. It comes from you loving yourself. And when I switched again to understanding that reality, I gave myself the ability to be happy because it's a choice each of us makes. It's not about what's out there. It's not about what somebody says. It's about how you feel inside. And that was probably the greatest lesson that I learned, but it did not happen overnight.
Wow. Thank you so much for being so honest about your journey and how you felt and the kind of situation you were in. Usually most people like to show the best part of their life and, you know, hide their suffering. But thank you. That was very honest of you, Doctor. And that's what I really like about you, the little conversations that we've had before. You know, I want to go back into neurosurgery, neuroscience, you know, because I just see your amazing journey from the first book to your latest book, Mind Magic. You know, you talk about the brain, you talk about neuroscience, you talk about manifestation, you talk about mindfulness. It's very rare for a medical doctor to eventually, you know, speak this way. So was it always part of your practice? Was it always part of your lectures to like talk, you know, hardcore science and neuroscience and also bring in the finer points of mindfulness and manifestation? And what inspired you to write Mind Magic?
Well, I think you only asked 10 questions, but
I want to know it all. Yeah.
Yes. But first of all, I was never a bad person. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I wasn't stealing things. I wasn't hurting people. I just was insecure and ashamed. But the problem was I wasn't focused on the right things, because what she taught me, which I didn't mention, after she taught me this practice of relaxing the body, if you want to call it taming the mind or changing to one, you're thinking to one of self-compassion and then compassion for others, the last thing she taught me was a manifestation technique. And more along the lines of what often is promoted as manifestation, which is sort of the more of the woo-woo type of stuff. And I did not have insight or self-awareness. And as a 12-year-old, I thought that being rich was important. And I remember as when I was younger, I saw a fellow drive by on a driving a Porsche. And I was very impressed with that. And then I had a friend who was very wealthy and his father was wearing a Rolex. So she had me make this list of things I wanted, and I included all essentially material things. And that was the journey I went on. And that is where I realized, after getting all the things I had wished for, it led to nowhere. And this is the key part, if you will, about manifestation. And what a lot of people don't understand, and that is that when you look at the world through the lens of saying, I want, I want, I want, that leads to a dead end of continued emptiness. And if you look at our evolution as a species, unlike many other species, when our offspring are born, they don't run off into the forest or the jungle. We have to take care of them. But what is the motivator for us to take care of them? And the motivator is that when we care for another, our offspring, and they are in pain, they're hungry, they're suffering, we are motivated to take care of them because we are rewarded. And the reward is the release of different types of neurotransmitters, of which the most well-known one is oxytocin, or this bonding or affiliative or love hormone. And when we care for another, that is released and our pleasure centers are stimulated and it feels good. So our default mode is to care for others. And this evolved from not only the nuclear family, but as we developed tribes, it was which typically were 50 to 150 people, it was absolutely critical in a hostile environment that people work together, that they cooperate, and that we ensure that they don't suffer. And as a result, this became a very strong aspect of who we are. So the problem is that oftentimes when you're saying, I want, it's because of your own insecurity and fear, which stimulates your sympathetic nervous system. And it may be at a very low level. I think it's also very common in modern society. And the problem with that is it actually negatively impacts different parts of your brain that are associated with manifestation. Now, that's not to say it won't happen. I'm just saying, if you look at manifesting, most of us who've never been exposed to that term and are just living our lives, we're all trying to manifest every day. We'll look at something and say, I'd like to be that, or I want that. But we don't have any tools. We just say it. Then you have another subset of people who have been, I believe, misled by books like The Secret. And The Secret teaches you a lot of the woo-woo techniques and this idea of law of attraction. But every statement is, I want. If I just get this, I'll be happy. And it's just not truth. But if you actually look at it through the lens of how can I be of service? How can I care? The likelihood of manifesting is much, much higher, especially with the techniques that we know through a variety of different experiments actually increase the likelihood of one manifesting. And this isn't to say that you ultimately don't personally benefit, but the primary objective is to do actions or have desires that are oriented around being of service or helping the other. And I think that's really, really the key here is this idea of understanding that our purpose in life is to care for the other. There are innumerable studies that demonstrate that the societies who are most successful in terms of longevity of that society always have to do with cooperative behavior and caring for others within your group.
Wow. Wow, that's a whole different spin on manifestation. But I like what you said. So could we kind of relate that to intent, the intent behind what I want to manifest? You know, if it comes from a space of love, if it comes from a space from care, it changes the whole energy of the affirmation or the manifestation. Is that correct, Doctor?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of people think that some of the stuff that is promoted through pseudoscience, or as some would say, woo-woo, actually works. And at some level, it may work. And I would use the analogy that as we have looked at different spiritual practices, which have evolved over many thousands of years, there are techniques that were incorporated because people develop them through the experience or experientially. And what I mean by that is these meditation practices that give you access to change your brain, if you will. These evolved over thousands of years, but they've ended up being associated with dogma attached to them. And that's typically the dogma of that religious practice or a spiritual practice. But neuroscience has actually caught up and has demonstrated that many of the things that are wrapped into religious or spiritual practices actually have a scientific basis. And so in some ways, this is analogous to the typical way of manifesting, which is by writing things down, repeating them, seeing yourself in those situations. And those actually do give you access, but understanding your intention, which I think is a very important thing. And what I mean by that is people, especially young people, they have a view of what they want. They don't understand the difference between what they want and actually what they need and will actually make them flourish. And I think that is really what we're talking about here. Because as you know, a lot of young people either want to be celebrities, influencers, or have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is it's because of this false narrative that we were talking about, that if you have success, prominence, wealth, position, that your life is going to be full and meaningful. And unfortunately, that's just not the case at all. And this is puts focus on the sad reality that you see these influencers who use all these filters, makeup, staging situations so that their life looks perfect, when in fact, in no way is their life perfect. And they're just running around expending immense amounts of energy so that people will look at them and tell them they're perfect. But from my own experience, and I think the experience of many of these people, telling somebody they're good or all right or okay, it doesn't help. It doesn't fill that void. And this is why we see, unfortunately, so many of these people either miserably unhappy, having mental illness, or frankly, commit suicide. But the other problem is that these people then are watched by a lot of people who believe their narrative, which then only makes their life more unhappy, because they sit there and they go, God, if I could just be like that person, but unfortunately, I neither have money, position, or power, and it's not going to happen. And then they're striving because they're always concerned about being judged by others. And it's having the security of who you are as a human being and accepting yourself that gives you that sense of acceptance and a sense of serenity and a feeling that you're okay. It doesn't come from external sources. And again, this is a narrative that has been promulgated over and over again. It's interesting, if you look at these blue zones in the world where, you know, people live typically a century. Well, I'm sure you know, and diet is important, and especially a plant-based diet. But the reality is, if you take all of the subtract all of these components, the diet, if you get the people not to smoke, if you moderate alcohol, if you remove every other of these components that contributes, in the big scope of things, they only make a small contribution to your longevity. And why is that? Because the most important contributor to longevity has to do with deep connections with others and depth of relationships, period. And so, yes, all the other stuff is great, but I'm sure you've seen the pictures of, let's say, somebody like Churchill, he's smoking his cigar, he's drinking his fourth scotch, he's morbidly obese, and, you know, he lives to like 98 or whatever it was. And there are people like that. Now, I'm not saying to do that. I'm just saying, though, By far and away, those are the most powerful contributors to longevity. And this is why in these blue zones, people grow up there, they die there, but they are accepted. People know everything about them. They know the good part, the bad part. The community there still loves them, tries to teach them. They're an intergenerational family situations. People are supportive of them. And so they don't have the stress and anxiety and fear of judgment that people often in Western cultures, modern Western cultures, have. And this is really actually one of the greatest contributors to poor health. And it all relates to the creating of unneeded stress and anxiety and ultimately depression.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, doctor, because every time I look at the blue zone data and then I look at, you know, the longevity fads and trends on social media, talking more about supplements, I mean, I'm not against them, but also talk about deep human connection, not just a supplement. Don't just talk about muscle without talking about compassion and care. Because, you know, my oldest living patient is now 102, and we have quite a few 100 and many in their 90s. And when I look at that small data pool, because that's the data pool that's real to me and that I have, okay, most of them have smoked, some of them still do, they drink, not promoting that. But the one commonality, and many of them haven't done that. Many of them still have a steak every night for dinner. Some of them are plant-based. But again, the one commonality is they feel a sense of belonging. They have routine. They're genuinely happy people, even though some of them have gone through World War II, you know, and they just know how to make the best out of life. They're forgiving. And those are the commonalities. None of them are on more than a vitamin D3 or a B12. You're an omega, that's about it. That's what they've been put on. And the rest of it is purely what you just say. And it's so refreshing to hear that, because I can't understand why the world can't focus on things that can help you. Okay, push plant-based, push whatever you want, but also talk about the truth, which is exactly what you're talking about, because that'll encourage people to start looking at their communities, investing more in families, you know, different kinds of relationships. Maybe the first one didn't work out. Maybe the second one didn't work out, but it doesn't mean we can't invest in meaningful relationships. So thank you for sharing that. You know, I mean, that's amazing. Yeah.
No, it's really true. And I think one of the challenges, especially in a capitalist society, is being kind and compassionate isn't a profit maker in the sense that you can't sell it and make tons of money. You can sell a zillion useless supplements. Yeah. You can sell gym memberships, but you know, somehow packaging kindness and compassion, it's readily available and it's free. Yet that is the most powerful contributor to our health. And I know, of course, that as you promote, there are other aspects which are important, such as adequate sleep, yeah, a moderate amount of exercise, watching your diet on some level, and actually having the right mental state. All of these things are absolutely important and critical. But again, as I was just saying, the most important thing is kindness to yourself, kindness to others. And if you do that, that changes not only your life, but it changes the life of everyone around you. It's interesting. We have these programs, 8-week-long programs, where we give a lecture, 2-hour lecture once a week, and then have people do different types of exercises that promote compassion and self-compassion. And the most extraordinary thing is you talk to these people, and, well, I should say their spouse or their children or their boss will talk to you and say, you know, their life is completely changed because it's so joyful to interact with them now. And this can extend not only to the individual, but even in the corporate environment, which is what's amazing. There are a number of studies that demonstrate when a company actually incorporates this type of narrative into the mission statement, it increases creativity, it increases productivity, it decreases healthcare costs, because you don't have all these costs for sort of these mind-body disconnects, headache, low back pain, gastrointestinal problems, fatigue. And then it actually decreases human resources costs, because, you know, people are much more willing to stay in a job longer instead of just leaving, or they'll take a promotion where normally they're unhappy and they don't want to have to deal with more responsibility. And so integrating compassion explicitly into every action you make changes everything.
So that brings me to the next question, Dr. James. Compassion. You started your whole journey. You traveled around the world. You met the Pope, the Dalai Lama, and all over leaders across the world. You know, what made you take off on that journey? And what are some of the learnings from each of these spiritual leaders, these leaders around compassion? I would love for you to share your learnings with us.
Sure. And it's interesting, because I tell people I'm an atheist, and everybody seems to be shocked by that. And it's not that I believe in nothing per se. I refuse to participate in a narrative that somehow says what I believe in is better than what you believe in.
True.
And my experience, and I would suggest to you, there's probably not a living human being who has interacted with as many spiritual and religious leaders around the world than I have. And I'm not saying that to brag. I think it's a reality. You know, three people who we've lost over the last few years, Archbishop Tutu, Thich Nhat Hanh, Solgo Rinpoche, who was the author of the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. I was close to all of them. But also, I'm close to Amma, the hugging saint, who's a dear friend, Sadhguru, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, Sri M, Daji, Radhana Swami, Chinanand in Rishikesh, Sadhvi, who's also there, but also Eckhart Tolle, Byron Katie. You may recall Werner Erhard of Est, Erhard Seminar Training from the 70s. He's actually 88 and still alive, and he's a close friend. But the interesting thing about every one of these individuals is that while on some level, especially a spiritual religious leader, relies on their dogma to help a lot of people, all of these people sit, these elevated spiritual beings sit above their dogma because they recognize that the dogma, while it can be helpful, is not the most important thing. What's the most important thing is, do you love? Are you non-judgmental? Do you accept people for who they are? Are you kind? Are you compassionate? These are the fundamental underpinnings in every person I just mentioned and so many others who are these elevated spiritual beings. That is how they see the world. And that is why when you're around them, and I'm sure you've been around some of these people, Sadhguru or the Dalai Lama, Amma, you immediately get a sense that you're accepted and you're okay as you are. And that is so, so powerful. And that's why they have all of these followers, because nothing is better to be in the presence of somebody who you immediately connect with, who wants nothing from you. They ask for nothing. They're just there to be vessels of love. And I know that may sound trite and sort of crazy, especially from a neuroscientist or a neurosurgeon, but that is the reality that I've experienced over many, many years. And it is such a joy still to me to visit and spend time with these individuals. I was recently in Hyderabad, and there's an ashram there called Kana Shanti Vanam.
Daji, which is, right?
Yes, exactly. Oh, you know Daji.
Been there. We worked very close. In fact, the names that you mentioned, I'm proud to say, you know, I've worked very closely with Gurudev, Sri Ravi Shankar. In fact, tomorrow morning, I fly out to Rishikesh and I shared a stage with Sadhviji. We met in the Maldives in October and we did a couple of sessions. And I'm invited to her ashram tomorrow and we're going to be talking on spirituality and health. So I'll tell her you said hi. Yeah.
Yes, she is a very dear friend. And in fact, there's something, I don't know if you know, it's called the Council of the Parliament of the World's Religions, and they meet every few years, and typically about 10,000 or so people 10,000 people show up, and it's a gathering of all these different religious groups, and they share what they're doing, they interact, they do programs together, and it's probably one of the biggest interfaith dialogues that there is. But the last one was in Chicago in the fall. And actually, Sadhvi and I did two programs on the stage together, and which was wonderful. And then I was in Hyderabad recently with Daji, who is a very close friend. And actually, we're doing some programs together. So it's a small world. In fact, I'm going to probably head to India in June to stop by and see a few of these people. The challenge for me is that I know so many of them, and they all get mad at me if I don't stay at their ashram.
Yeah, that would be a tricky one, choosing which one.
Yeah, because I would spend about 5 months or 6 months running around. And but anyway, it's always a wonderful pleasure to hang out. So that's great. It sounds like we have a lot of paths that intersect.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that. And, you know, I wanted to talk about neuroplasticity, you know, just go a little technical into the subject that you once taught and, you know, all the patients that you've seen over the years. Can you explain to us, you know, how we can use our knowledge of neuroplasticity, the very fact that we have the ability to change the architecture of our brain by changing our thoughts? Can you give us a couple of tools by, you know, also explaining in simple terms what this means? So I want to empower people with the thought that wherever they are right now watching this, watching you, they have a starting point. They can start right now.
Well, I think that statement's incredibly important. People have a tendency to sit there and say, well, it's too late. And whether it's being overweight, whether it's a spiritual practice, whatever it is, so common, people go, oh, I'm too old, or it's too late, or I've been bypassed by X, Y, or Z. It's never too late. And certainly, it's never too late to change your brain. And people, again, have a tendency to give their agency away. And this is the power you have over your thoughts, and look outward for affirmation. In fact, I'm sure you've been in the position, as almost everyone has, where you have some dream, belief, aspiration, and you'll share it publicly or out loud. And you'll have people even close to you, relatives, say, you're not going to do that. That's not possible. And it's so, so unfortunate, because it is possible. The problem with so many people is because they're not able to do it, they don't want you to do it. Or they want to sort of have the sense that they have power over you. And what I want to emphasize is that you're the one who has all the power. When you use negative thoughts about yourself, it's like you're building the walls of a prison. And as those walls get higher and higher, it gets darker and darker, and it sort of reinforces this narrative. But as we were talking about, you do have the power to overcome that. Now, let me just comment on a couple of things. One is, we were talking about manifesting your intention. What people don't appreciate is that while our sensory organs, which in many ways define who we are, what we think we are by all this data that comes in, 99.99% of that occurs at a subconscious level and is associated with maintaining body homeostasis so that everything works. There's actually about 50 to 100 bits of information out of that 10 million bits of information that come in every second that actually is at a conscious level. And it's understanding that you have the ability to embed on a conscious level aspects of manifestation to have an intention occur. And that's really where the key is. Many of the manifestation techniques use techniques that now have been proven by neuroscience. So some of the most important things is, one is a relaxation or breathing exercise, or you may want to call it a mindfulness exercise, because what that does is it allows you to be calm and be present. And in fact, when we're talking about even connection, you have to be present to allow you to connect with another human being. And you can't be distracted thinking about a future that hasn't happened, or some goal you want, which occurs a lot, or beating yourself up again about what could have been or might have been or should have been. So one is, you have to get back here, not be off over there. And these types of practices we were just talking about allow you to have that ability. Once you're present, then you can use the techniques of embedding your intention. And this is actually through many of the exercises, such as writing your intentions down or what you wish to manifest. But it has to be associated with a why. Mm-hmm. And the why is I want, the ability to have that manifest is, I believe, markedly decreased versus I want to be of service. I want to help others. If I create a situation where these people benefit, then I will benefit. But it's not about the I, it's about the we. And so by writing things them down, by reading them silently, by reading them aloud, by repetition, by visualizing yourself in that situation, all of these are very, very powerful techniques. And we have these areas in the brain, which are called cognitive brain networks, which are different parts of the brain, but that in certain circumstances work together. And one of those is what is called the salience network. How do you make an intention salient? And there's a sub part of that, if you will, called the attention network. So when you do these practices, what occurs is that there's something called value tagging. It tags it and it becomes a subconscious intention, which then connects to your executive control network, which then has an effect on your default mode network. And we don't need to go into all of that complicated anatomy. But the point is that it then releases, if you will, a bloodhound, which will search around and around to help you manifest your intention. And what I mean by that is, I'm sure you've been at parties where there's a lot of noise, but if your name is mentioned, you turn to that. Even though there's all this ambient noise, you would never pay attention to it, because who you are, how you identify yourself, is deeply embedded with you. And what happens is, and I'll give you an example of what's happened to me recently, if you embed an intention, and I was at a coffee shop and I had been thinking about a project that I wanted to do. And again, you know, everyone's talking in the coffee shop. Well, suddenly I heard somebody talking about the exact thing that I was doing because I was attuned to it. And that led me to engage in a conversation. It led me to meet these individuals who I'm now working with. And so it's also like, as an example, as a neurosurgeon, you know, I will tell somebody they have a particular condition and they'll say, I have never heard of that. Really? This must be really rare. I'll see them 2 months later and they go, wow, it's the most amazing thing. I've run into five people with the same thing, right? And it's because now it's been embedded and they're attuned to searching their environment for things that relate to that. And this is how manifestation works. And it's not to say that, one, it always occurs. It doesn't, because there are other factors that can negatively contribute. Two, people have to be patient, because it doesn't work in the timeline you want, no matter how much we want. And I think, you know, the third aspect of this is you have to be realistic. If I said, you know, I want to be the first human to land on Mars, the likelihood of that is non-existent. So you have to put it in also a realistic framework. But utilizing those techniques, and my book, Mind Magic, actually offers a six-week or six-step program that utilizes all the techniques of neuroscience to increase the likelihood of you manifesting your intention. But I would also suggest, and we talk about God or religion, I would say that God only helps those who help themselves. So this is not a zero work project. You have to put in the time, you have to understand and utilize these practices, or that obviously dramatically increases the likelihood for it occurring.
Well, that's great. So what you talk about, you know, those parts of the brain, is this similar to the reticulating, you know, activating center of the brain?
You're getting into too much anatomy for yourself there. The RAS is in your brainstem, and it's reticular activating system, and it's associated with consciousness or an awake state. And while certainly that interacts with a whole variety of different parts of your brain, that's not directly related to what we're talking about today. although obviously indirectly it is, because you have to be awake to do these practices.
Yeah, got it. Okay, cool. That's helpful. You're the CEO of Happy, and I kind of really enjoyed you taking me through that demo of the app. I wanted to ask you, what was your vision behind this, and what are some of the data coming in? You know, you managed to integrate mental health and AI together. I would love for you to explain to our audience about this app and what you've been working on right now.
Sure. Thanks for asking about that. As you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners, mental health is a huge problem right now, and primarily related to living in the modern world. We were talking about the blue zones and how people lived a much simpler life, but they were surrounded by people who supported them, encouraged them, and were there for them. In modern society, unfortunately, most people are not living in proximity to their loved ones, their family members, their siblings. Often they're in high stress jobs that make significant demands on their time. And of course, many people are not receiving an income that allows them to live comfortably or to take care of their families. So every one of these is a massive contributor to stress and anxiety and oftentimes depression. What we do know is, though, and we get back again to this idea of the blue zones or connecting to somebody, we know that oftentimes simply being able to have a conversation with someone who asks the right questions, listens intently, is empathic, compassionate, non-judgmental, and accepting, simply being with somebody like that can have a huge, huge positive effect. Now, one of the challenges with therapists is, while they're great, there are two limitations. Well, maybe three. One, they're only available typically in most places 9 to 5. So for the average person, which is when those are the times they work, they're completely distracted from their distress because of the requirements of their job or interacting. When most people get the most stress and anxiety is in the evening when they're by themselves. And you have this voice saying, I need to get this done. I should have done this. Oh my God, if I don't do that, this is going to happen. And of course, if you call the therapist at that time, what do you get? At least in the United States, you get this. If this is a life-threatening emergency, please call 911, which is not the most soothing type of response an individual suffering wants to hear. So looking at this, there were a couple other insights which I think are critically important. Oftentimes, when you talk about, as an example, human avatars, you sit there and you go, well, how could somebody connect with an avatar? And I'm sure some of the listeners and yourself have tried virtual reality glasses. Well, typically what they'll do is they'll change the scenario where from where you're standing, let's say in your office, to now you're on a plank overlooking an abyss, right? And I will tell you that 99.9% of people, even though on a conscious level, they say, I'm wearing VR glasses, they will not jump off that plank, right? And because you've hijacked their subconscious, and that's what you're connecting with, even though on a conscious level, they know it's not real. And what I would suggest to you, and I think there's a lot of evidence, when you connect with an empathic, non-judgmental human avatar, you make an emotional connection to it. And that's really, really important, because there are chatbots, and this is not to say that they are not necessarily helpful, but they're chatbots that use AI. But imagine you're just typing, and that typing's going off into the Netherlands somewhere. There's no emotional connection. And in fact, the other problem is, if you type I'm sad, there's no valence. And what I mean by that is, are you sad I'm going to commit suicide sad? Or are you sad I stubbed my toe sad? And those are far different things, which then also require a whole much more typing to get insight into. And then you get this response oftentimes from an AI, and then it theoretically gives you advice. And I'm not negating that that can be useful, and there's some apps that do that. In the space of mental well-being, though, there's a fair broad spectrum. One, of course, and I'm sure you're familiar with, is Headspace and Calm. They're the ones that are touted the most. And there are literally thousands of imitations of these. And in fact, a lot of that content is free and readily available on the internet. What's fascinating is each of those have raised hundreds of millions of dollars. And I used to be a consultant for Calm. In fact, they would give my book to every new employee. I, when they signed up their 10 millionth person, and now they've signed up over 150 million, I actually gave a talk at their headquarters. And in fact, I have a Calm story. I also know one of the founders of Headspace. The problem is, first of all, many of these techniques were not necessarily specifically meant for mental health issues. And the other is that because this information is so readily available, even though they've each signed up over 150 million people, on a daily basis, only 2 to 4 million people use them every day. So they have no stickiness. And this is, frankly, after 7 or 8 years, probably why those companies have not gone public, because all their revenue is spent on client acquisition. And so that is one area that is out there available for people. The other is online therapy. But the challenge with that for so many people is, one, there are not enough therapists for everybody, but two, it's extraordinarily expensive. And if you look at, it's great to have, you get to talk to your therapist for 50 minutes once a week, but all of our difficulties in life don't occur on Wednesday at 2 p.m. You know, maybe our appointment, you know, it may be at midnight on Sunday and you're very anxious sitting in bed reliving a narrative in your head. Well, so here is what we have created based on some of the things I was just talking about. One is, and just to tell your listeners, it's happy with an I, happi.ai. And please go there and you can learn more about it. And you can even sign up for a trial that we're doing. But imagine a situation where you sign in on your phone app. You're actually greeted, but this is actually tracking your emotional state on the fly, where it's looking at your facial expressions, it's listening to your voice and analyzing it, it's understanding the context of a conversation to understand your emotional state through the conversation. And the important thing about that, unlike just typing in "I'm sad," it's actually looking at you during the conversation. So it's assessing whether the conversation is moving in a positive direction or a negative direction. The other thing is, as you're familiar with, and I'm sure some of your listeners have experienced, is AI can lie to you. It does something called hallucinating. And in fact, I asked it one time to write a bio for me. And what was amazing about it was it said, "And Dr. Doty has won 10 prominent awards, and 5 of them were just completely made up." Now, of course, I still put them on my bio. But they were just made up out of the blue. And this is the danger potentially of just being on a open AI platform. What we have done is we have a constrained AI or a contained AI. And the reason I mention that is it contains psychology, millions of pages of articles, and compassion-focused therapy. So it that is its space, and that sits on top of the LLM. we don't allow you necessarily, except in some rare instances, to have access to an LLM itself. And that way it doesn't hallucinate and it keeps you on point. As an example, the other thing that sometimes people will do is to try to troll the app or depending on their mental health issues, they may try to develop an intimate relationship. And there are apps that allow you to do that to the point where you'd be shocked. But ours is constrained. So my son, who was 20, was using the app one time, and he asked the avatar, whose name was Olivia, for if she would go out on a date with him.
Okay.
What she said, I'm happy to watch a movie with you or go on play a online game with you, but only if this is going to help your mental health. So she stays pretty on point there. But she can actually give you some amazing and oftentimes interesting insights. And she'll also recommend or teach you different types of meditation practices based on sort of the domain where you mentally are, which may be relating to a physiologic response you're having versus a cognitive response versus a behavioral response. And these are terms, as you know, used in psychology, but the responses she has are attuned to each of those things from the conversation. The other great thing, of course, is she knows a little bit about your background and she has a memory. So if every, for 5 weeks you're talking about issues with your spouse, then she may sit there and say, how is it going with your spouse? Did you try this technique we had talked about? And the thing is, it also helps you gain familiarity and feel comfortable by her cueing you with things. Because again, having a conversation with a friend, which is what's really important here, in and of itself is the most calming thing that decreases stress and anxiety. And yes, all of these other things are important, but human, and I say human interaction, but a sense that you're interacting with somebody who cares for you is really, really important, even though on a cognitive level, you know, this is an avatar, but you cannot help but respond to it as if this is a friend who you're talking to. Now, I'm not saying, and people frequently will sit there and say, oh my God, you're separating people from reality. So they're talking to an avatar and that's all they want to talk to. But the reality is these types of conversations and the way we structure it actually improves your interaction with others and makes you feel more calm so that you're not afraid to interact with others, not that you're going in your room at night hanging out with the avatar. Mm-hmm. And you ask about a few studies. So we've done some internal studies. And one was with a group of individuals who we had them use the app for a minimum of 10 minutes a day for 1 week, very short study. And we did a pre and a post analysis using a self-report technique that has been published in a ton of psychology papers that it rates your feelings from 1 to 5. 1 is normal, 5 extremely severe, both in the area of stress, anxiety, and depression. Over 70% of people, 1 week, minimum 10 minutes a day, had a 2-level improvement in each of those categories, over 70% of people, which is fascinating, just simply by talking to somebody. And this was an earlier version of the app. And essentially 100% said, well, can I still continue using the app after the study's done? More recently, we've tracked hundreds of people. And what we found is that we were talking about stickiness, at least in this preliminary data, it appears as though happy is probably about 3 times more sticky than many of the apps I was just mentioning to you earlier. And again, I think it's because of this connection to the avatar. So I think it's very, very powerful. Right. Now, again, it's not perfect yet, but none of us are perfect yet. Although we're trying to, but I believe that, and we're going to try and launch this in the next 3 months. I believe that once we launch this, that it will improve over time fairly quickly, because every interaction the app has with you or the avatar actually improves the interaction you have, because the avatar gets to know you.
Wow. Dr. James, this has been amazing. I wanted to end this by, if the whole world was watching you right now, what's that message you have for all of us? With your years of experience from the time you were a child, you moved into med school, neurosurgery, neuroscience, to compassion. What's that one message with all of your learnings, life lessons, and experiences? What would you leave us with?
I think there are two aspects. Most people don't understand or appreciate the power they have within themselves to change their own lives or the lives of others. The other thing is that regardless of our position, our wealth, our status, every one of us every day has the ability to improve the life of at least one person. And that can be a smile, that could be buying a meal for someone who's hungry, that can be opening a door. But every one of those acts can change the life of somebody, and you will cannot possibly imagine how those simple actions can change that life. And I cannot tell you how many people have come up to me, and I don't even remember them. And I've had people come and go, you know, 5 years ago, we talked for about 5 minutes. I have no idea who these people are. And they'll go, but from that, I did this, and now my life has changed. And I'm not saying that I'm that important to do that. But what I am saying is, even small little acts, you cannot even believe how that can change someone's life. And everyone has that ability to do so. And when you do that, not only does that help the other person, but it profoundly helps yourself. And this gets back to this idea of connection and longevity. When you're connecting with people, when you're kind, when you're thoughtful, that is the primary activator for each of us to live a long and happy life.
That's beautiful, powerful. I feel you. I feel everything you said. I have this concept of planting seeds every day. Just go on planting them, you know, kind seeds, seeds of service. It's going to sprout one day. Some may not, but I feel you, Dr. James. Thank you so much. This has been profound, amazing. Hope to see you in India. I am going to manifest meeting you in California really soon, and to take off on a couple of things we spoke about earlier. And I kind of feel it and see it happening already. So thank you once again. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, Luke, you take care of yourself, and you'll be in my thoughts, and I'll look forward to our meeting. And again, say hello to Sadhvi. Tell her I love her.
I will do that tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay, my friend. Take care. Bye.
Stay tuned for more. We're going to continue our journey, learning, sharing, and evolving.